Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, episode 2472 with strength coach Michael Wolf. And you may hear me call him Wolf because, believe it or not, that is how he is popularly known. And we want to talk about, well, strength training, fitness, and myths and realities. Because as with everything else, we've learned that everything else in life is full of BS and nonsense and platitudes that everybody believes but aren't actually true. And it turns out that extends also into our friend Wolf's area of expertise here. Anyway, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you, Tom. I'm very excited to be here. I don't know if you know this, your podcast is actually the first podcast I ever listened to on a regular basis. So like the old 90s commercials, I'm not only the president, but I'm also a client.
All right. Well, take that, Michael Malice. Okay. Well, and by the way, I first met you. Didn't we play Quiplash together at a get-together with Malice?
That's right. That's the first time we met, I think about six years ago, give or take.
Yeah.
Back in NYC.
Yeah. And the thing with Quiplash, and for anybody who if you don't know, the cleverer and snarkier and quicker you are, the better. And I was just getting buried by the people in that room. Like, people in that room were so edgy in their humor and so quick with it that there's just I just couldn't keep up. I mean, it was like a Malice dream. I will say, before we get into this stuff we want to talk about today, I mentioned in a recent episode that Malice and Dave Smith and a couple of others and I did a little benefit Quiplash game early in 2020 when everybody was shut in to benefit Meals on Wheels New York City. And so we had a big audience, like hundreds of people online watching. And we were able to play, because that's one of the features of Quiplash. You can play with an audience and the audience can collectively vote. Whatever their majority says counts as a vote for one side or the other. And so one of the questions pitted Malice against me. And the prompt was, name the thing you would least likely want to hear your significant other say.
Oh boy.
And he said, "I'm leaving you for Tom Woods." But I said simultaneously, "I'm leaving you for Michael Malice." It was perfect.
That's amazing. Now, I don't know if you'll believe this. That was actually the first time I ever played Quiplash. So I was pretty...
Oh, you were a natural.
I was pretty happy to hold my own among such august company.
Yes, no, that's not an easy crowd to win that in. Okay, so first of all, the word training, a lot of times I hear this, you know, I'm going to go train. I never like that word because I feel like I train for something. Well, I'm not going to run a marathon. I'm not going to be in a weightlifting competition. So I feel weird saying I'm going to go train. So I just say I'm going to go to the gym, even though I am working with a personal trainer. But there is nevertheless a distinction between quote unquote training and what we call exercise. Maybe you might distinguish between these for us?
Sure. And you already hinted to the conceptual difference. Exercise is any type of physical activity that you do for, let's just call it, its immediate impact, how it makes you feel or what it does in the moment or soon after. It burns calories in the moment. It works up a sweat in the moment. It gets you moving. You know, doing something is better than doing nothing. It doesn't have any type of long-term goal, which is kind of what you alluded to. That's exercise. So exercise could be almost anything physical, almost any physical activity. And that is certainly better than not doing anything. Like, we have a lot of people out in the country, in the world, in the first world especially, who are so sedentary that anything, even if it's just taking a 10-minute walk after each meal 3 times a day, would be a massive improvement to what they're doing now, right? They're just doing nothing. I recently saw some statistics that obesity is now a bigger issue than malnutrition in I forget if it was in the US or in the first world as a whole, I forget exactly. But for us now, we're in a unique position in human history where our basic living doesn't require physical labor on a large scale anymore. Obviously, we still have professions that are physical laborers, but on a large scale, we have a bigger obesity problem than a undernutrition, a malnutrition problem in the first world, in America anyway. So exercise is anything that gets you moving, works up a sweat, makes you feel, I mean, some people like it, some people don't, maybe it makes you feel bad, but it has an immediate or soon after impact. Training, like you implied, is a directed activity or series of activities that progressively kind of give a progressive path towards a goal. And I use progressive, of course, not in the political sense, but in the sense that you're making progress towards something. It's not just one random activity on Monday and a different random activity on Wednesday. What you do Monday is built on by what you do Wednesday. And what you do Friday builds on what you had done Monday and Wednesday. And each training session is a building block towards a goal. And the goal, as you alluded to, some people like to compete even as adults in, you know, recreational leagues or, you know, whether it's running a marathon or a weightlifting competition, they're not doing it as their career, but they just like to do it competitively. But even people who aren't competitive can set goals in that matter. If you're running, you might say, okay, I'm not going to enter a race, but I'd like to be able to, for my own self, I'd like to be able to run 3 miles in less than 25 minutes. I'd like to be able to deadlift 315 pounds. Whatever the particular goal is, you're working towards that goal. And that's what training is as opposed to exercise. So training is actually, it's thoughtful, it's planned out, it has structure to it, and it builds on itself over time rather than just being, you know, I took a walk today, I did yoga tomorrow, I went to the, you know, this Zumba class on Wednesday. So that's really what the difference between training and exercise is and how it applies, even if you're not going to do a competition.
All right, let me interject something at this point. I know we're going to talk about strength and training for strength and what the merits of that is, but
sure.
There is this eternal question about the role that quote unquote cardio plays or should play in somebody's regimen. And there are some people who get a gym membership so they can go use the treadmill. Now, I go to a gym that has no treadmills at all, that has no cardio equipment whatsoever. But that, for some people, that is their regimen.
Yeah.
And I have some people who say cardio is, you don't have to worry about it. It's just, if you're reasonably active in your life, you don't even have to worry about it. Is there a happy medium between these two, or is one side right and the other is wrong?
I think generally there's a happy medium between those two, as we'll discuss, hopefully, when we get to the strength, meat and potatoes of strength. I do think strength is much less appreciated. Its importance is much higher than people give it credit for. And the importance of cardio is not as high as the average person, the average doctor, the average just person out there gives it credit for. But that doesn't mean it's not important. It just means it's relatively, in my opinion, overvalued compared to strength, and strength is undervalued compared to how it really should be valued compared to cardio. But usually when I get someone new for strength, if somebody is really completely untrained, they're weak, they will get a decent amount good cardio just by improving their strength for the first few months. It's not a permanent strategy, but they can usually just do strength training for a few months. Once they're a few months in, I usually do have people start to do some cardio, but it doesn't have to be crazy. You don't have to do an hour every day. Even if you do something as simple as what I mentioned before, take a 10 or 15 minute walk 3 times a day right after you eat, or take a 30 or 40 minute walk once a day if you can't, you know, sometimes at work or whatever, you can't walk right after you eat, something like that. That helps a lot in terms of basic general health. You don't have to do 5 miles a day on the treadmill and as hard as you can. And in fact, for a lot of people, that kind of impact ends up wearing on them over time. So you can pick something that has lower impact. You can pick something that's not as crazy intense all the time. And you can still get a lot of benefit from that. I do like to give people cardio once they're a little bit developed in strength, but usually it's about twice a week, 3 times, sometimes if they're sedentary, you know, if people don't have a lot of activity in their daily life. And I think that's a pretty happy medium. If you're doing strength training 3 times a week, 4 times a week, cardio 2 or 3 times a week, you're pretty good. You don't have to be an hour a day on the treadmill or anything like that.
Okay. Just wondering, because that is a legit question a lot of people have. Okay, so why do you call yourself a strength coach? You wouldn't say you're a personal trainer. What's the difference between these things?
So that really goes back to what we talked about training versus exercise. Our marginal revolution friends taught us about the value of everything is subjective, right? Subjective value. So some people don't value training, but they know they're supposed to exercise for general health. Like what I was just talking about for cardio just before was talking about general health. Obviously, if you want to run a marathon, you can't just walk 15 minutes three times a day and then go run a marathon. So we're talking about, I was talking about general health. So if you just kind of want to be general, basic level of disease risk reduction, exercise is fine. And most personal trainers are good at that because they make you come and show up. That's really what their best aspect is. You have an appointment with someone, you're going to show up and you're going to do something for 45 minutes or an hour, and you're not going to be sedentary. And they have some expertise in, you know, doing things that maybe that you enjoy that you wouldn't have thought of to do yourself, or pushing you a little bit harder than you would have pushed yourself, or maybe you wouldn't have showed up at all. Personal trainers often don't have a specialty beyond that. And I used to be one. I started out in the industry almost 20 years ago as a personal trainer, just like any other. And after a few years, I went into management for a gym corporation. And I really wasn't that satisfying because I was working with people whose goals were so amorphous that after a little while, it was difficult to keep them motivated because they were just thinking, I just want to get back into shape. Well, were you ever in shape in the first place? What does in shape even mean? It's kind of vague, doesn't have a lot of, there's no boundaries to it. There's nothing specific about it. So I started getting into the strength training thing about 15 years ago, strength coaching specifically. And so once I was pretty good at it, enough to specialize, enough to attract people who wanted to do it just for that, I started calling myself a strength coach because although I can do general fitness stuff, I can do general health stuff, what I really like doing and what people come to me for is really specifically to get stronger, to train for strength rather than to exercise for general health, avoiding being sedentary.
And you have to, especially when you have a lifestyle like mine that involves sitting in front of a screen for extended periods of time, you have to make an active effort to do something, to get out and do something.
You really
do. It's very easy to just fall into this routine of, I sit all day, then I go relax. And then I start another day where I sit all day.
After 10 hours at the screen, you kind of want to relax, right?
Yeah, that's right. Which consists of activities very similar to sitting at the screen. So, all right. Now, do you feel weird if I ask you about Mark Ripitoe?
I don't feel weird, no.
Okay. I've had him on a long time ago. In fact, we have an email thing going, and I think it's my turn to respond to him. But he has a particular outlook on what strength coaching ought to look like and what your regimen ought to look like that's different from what you'll see a lot of trainers teaching. Do you basically subscribe to his starting strength model? And if so, how's that different from what I'm going to get if I go into Joe's gym down the street?
Okay, that's a great question. A lot of people know about him and have a somewhat warped view of what he actually teaches based on, you know, one clip taken out of context or listening to what people who hate him say about him. So I'll try to clarify as best I can. Now, for a bit about my history, he was probably the most influential person in my own training growth. I worked with him as a coach at his seminars for 7 or 8 years. Very familiar with his book. I was kind of on the inner circle. And unfortunately, about 4 or 5 years ago, that relationship ended for reasons that have nothing to do. Me and him had no direct issues. It was indirect related to other people. So I don't have that active relationship with anymore, but I still highly respect both him and his work. And I probably agree 90 to 95% with that. So it's kind of like what we have when we see somebody from the Mises Institute who has a disagreement with Rothbard. You know, it happens once in a while. They may say, okay, I think actually I can figure out how to apply those principles even better than he did to one particular area or another. So I have a few different things where I have a slightly different take. But broadly speaking, I would say I'm very much in alignment with Ripitoe and starting strength, even though I have a few areas where I have a slightly different approach or something like that. So what his approach is, it really emphasizes strength. And it emphasizes objective increases in the bar, the weight on the bar, and objective standards for technique. That's one of the real things that people get uppity about. A lot of people want to say, everybody's different, just do what feels good, find the way that works for you. And there's a little bit of truth in that. It's, you know, there's a tiny bit of different, you know, there people have different length arms, different length legs, different length torsos. There's slight individual differences, but the human organism is essentially the same for everybody with some small differences. So you can find universal rules that will apply. here is the technique that is going to be most efficient. And then you make a micro adjustment within this tiny amount of the individual differences. And that's what really, I think, gets people up in arms is Rip is, he's very strict about do it this way. And that's one of the things where I'm like 2% off from that. I'm a little bit more open to the individual difference thing that he is. And he is open to that. I don't mean to give the wrong impression. He does talk about differences in anthropometry, which are kind of those limb length and body length differences that I talked about. My own experience has just been, I've coached thousands of people at this point, that there's a little bit more room for variation than he tends to go. But I also am very sensitive to understanding why he's so strict about keeping his standards, because in some ways it's kind of like opening Pandora's box. Once you allow that one or two exceptions, then people take that to like, oh, well, it's all arbitrary, just do whatever you want. And then that opens the floodgates to no technique, it doesn't matter, just do what feels good. So I think those standards are universal with some exceptions. And people don't like to hear that there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. You know how that's true for a lot of things these days. People don't like to hear this is better and this is worse, this is right and this is wrong. And the way I think about it is it's not like a math equation. 1 + 1 = 2, regardless of how many, you know, postmodern word games you want to play with it. Strength training, biology, physiology is more exists within ranges, right? There's no normally developed human that's 2 feet tall, and there's no normally developed human that's 17 feet tall. But, you know, 99% of people are between 5 and 7 feet tall or whatever the actual numbers are. So there's a little bit of range within which to adjust things. But we have to be very careful not to start playing, manipulation games and excuses to do things however we want just because we feel like it. So his approach is you focus on strength first, you add weight to the bar, you learn technique, and then once you've got the technique down, you add weight to the bar every single time you train until you can't anymore, which is usually about a 2 to 6 month process. We call that the linear progression. While doing that, you eat to support your training. If you're underweight, you're going to have to eat a lot more. If you're overweight, you probably can even lose some fat while you do this because you'll be active where you weren't active before. But that will depend on the individual. And we call this the novice linear progression. And it takes advantage of the fact that as a novice at anything, just like when you're new at the piano, you can go from not knowing how to play the piano to being somewhat competent in a shorter amount of time than it takes to go from being very competent to concert level pianist. Right? Or like an English degree, you learn your first words. You know, it takes less time to learn how to go from not speaking at all as an infant to speaking a few sentences. It just takes a few years to do that. But it might take you 20 or 25 more years to get a PhD in English. So those early gains, the less good you are at the thing, the quicker you can make progress at the thing. And Ripito came up with this novice linear progression that takes advantage of that. And as long as you eat and sleep, et cetera, to support that goal, you can actually get quite a bit stronger in a pretty short amount of time. And that's really where he's made a massive impact. And a lot of people don't like that because it kind of suggests that there is actually a better and a worse way to do things, a right and a wrong way. And a lot of people don't really like to talk about things in those terms.
Well, one thing that a layman might remember about his approach is his emphasis simply on lifting weights and his de-emphasis on using all kinds of highfalutin machines. Now, he has his reasons for that, but that's where his emphasis is. It's just lifting, old-fashioned lifting weights. Is that your general approach? And if so, what's the matter with all the different machines I might use?
Okay, that is a good question. That's one of the cases where I'm 5% different than him.
Okay, let's hear it then.
I'm definitely on his side, but I'm a little less rigid about it. So the thing is, if you do those machines, you will get somewhat stronger. It's indisputable. The problem is, once you say that, people are like, well, if I'm going to get stronger anyway, why should I bother learning the barbell thing? It's harder. It takes more techniques. So I'll just do the machines. And the machines have a much lower ceiling on what they can give you. The barbell work that Ripito teaches and shows you how to do really has a much higher level of efficacy over the course of time. So we really want to steer people away from the machines, not because it doesn't do anything. It's definitely better than doing nothing. It's definitely better than being sedentary. It's definitely better than only walking, right? If you do, let's say, walking and machines. But the problem is it's that bar is so low that if you say, well, that's okay too, because it's better, then people are like, okay, I guess that's good enough for me. And they're less likely to put themselves out there to actually do the barbell training, which has a much higher efficacy, gives you a much greater ceiling. So as a rhetorical strategy, it kind of makes sense to be really militant about that. But if I'm speaking purely in terms of exercise physiology, the machines have some efficacy. And I think actually later in your lifting career, once you're already very strong, they come back in to a slightly greater degree than they in the beginning. You don't really need them at all. For advanced lifters, sometimes advanced lifters need that little cherry on top that the beginners don't to kind of push things a little further. So sometimes that stuff becomes useful for advanced lifters. But the problem is it doesn't have any balance, doesn't have any coordination. It doesn't allow you to kind of systemically load the whole body in an axial manner in a way that has systemic effects. It's more isolates specific muscle groups. And the way that we use our body in the real world is in coordination, right? When you walk, you're not just flexing your quad and extending your quad to move your knee. It's in coordination with the glutes, with the hamstrings, all the musculature about the hip, the musculature about the knee, the musculature about the ankle. Well, what actually does that? A squat does that. A deadlift does that. A knee extension on the machine doesn't do that. A hamstring curl on the machine doesn't do that. So it's not that we're trying to make the movement look like what we do in daily life. That's a mistake. We're not trying to make our squat look like walking, or we're not trying to make our squat look like a cycling pedal stroke. That's a mistake that sport-specific coaches sometimes make. We're trying to do the movement in the general context. General is the key word here. The general context in which we use these muscles in real life in a way that allows us to load the most weight through a full range of motion so that we can get stronger. It's really all about strength. Strength, we didn't really talk about the definition yet, but a good quick definition for our purposes is the ability to produce force against an external resistance, right? Force being that physical quantity that causes things to move. So if you can produce force, so whenever you're walking, you push against the ground to create the force to walk, and then you catch yourself, you absorb the force and push against the ground again to catch yourself on each step. So we're trying to train in a way that facilitates the most efficient increases in the production of force. And these big lifts the Ripito emphasizes are really the most efficient way to do that, especially for a beginner. As I said, for someone who's been training for 3 years, 4 years consistently, they might get a little bit of benefit from doing some of those machines on top. So if, for example, in the squat, let's say you've been training for 5 years and you're now squatting 500 pounds. If you squat two or three days a week, like you did in the beginning, 500 pounds, that's going to put a lot of stress on your body. It's different than when you were squatting 100 pounds 5 years ago. So sometimes a leg press machine on a light day or a little bit of extra work that doesn't load the spine with 500 pounds. Now, don't get me wrong, loading the spine is good. If we subject our bodies to a challenging but doable good stress, give it the sleep and nutrition to recover, we then adapt and get stronger. But there is a certain amount of fatigue and recovery capacity that we just don't have. So if you're able to squat 600 pounds, you might benefit from doing a little bit of your legwork in an isolated machine that doesn't put that 600 pounds on your back 3 days a week, right? That makes sense. But if you're only subjecting yourself to that 100 pounds of stress or 200 pounds of stress when you're new, and for people who haven't lifted, I know 200 pounds sounds like a lot, but most people get to 200 pounds well before they've been doing it for a year, usually within a few months. Obviously not older people, you know, women have a different curve, older people have a different curve, but if you're, let's say, a 20 to 40 year old male, most people get to a 200 pound deadlift very quickly. It's actually shockingly quickly. So it's actually not that much weight if you actually apply yourself to this. So the idea is that these exercises that allow us to go through a full range of motion, longest effective range of motion with the most weight in a kind of perfectly repeatable movement pattern that, as I mentioned with the walking thing, it works in the context of the way we use these muscles in real life. Not in isolation, but kind of all in integration, all while standing, right? Because if you have to avoid falling down while doing the thing, that trains all the muscles that work to make you not fall down, as opposed to in a machine where you're kind of all sitting there and you're just in isolation and you're just working that one muscle. So it's a really effective way to get stronger. And what I tell people is you don't really ever need the machines, ever. If you become sufficiently advanced, they can become useful. Like I use them now more than I did 5-10 years ago because I've squatted over 600 pounds, I've deadlifted over 700 pounds. At a certain point, I can't put that much weight on my back all the time. But for people who are new, you don't really need them. And technically, you don't ever need them. I would just adjust my training. If I didn't have access to them, I would just adjust my training a little bit to have some more light days and maybe space more time between some of the workouts. So you don't ever need them. And that's kind of where the key is. So I guess it may come down to a rhetorical strategy where if people think that it's good enough to use them, they're less likely to put in the time and effort to learn how to do the barbell work, which is really much more efficacious. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Hey, everybody, it's Ol Woods here with a mini interview with our friend Jeff Deist, whose appearances on The Tom Woods Show you all love so much. And we're talking about Monetary Metals, where he works now, and you've heard me talk about this nonstop. So now it's going to be Jeff's turn to talk about it. Jeff, tell me about Monetary Metals. What is the value here?
Well, Tom, remember back in the day when Ron Paul used to ask Ben Bernanke, then chairman of the Federal Reserve, what's gold? What's the purpose of gold? Is it money? Why does the Fed hold it? And of course, he waffled and said it's a historical relic and it's just a precious metal, but it's not. I mean, for more than 5,000 years, gold's been money. There's $13 trillion worth of it out there just sitting around in bank vaults. Why don't we generate some interest from that? Why don't we put it to work as money, as a capital asset? That's the idea behind Monetary Metals.
So what does a person have to do to be part? Do you have to come in there owning your own gold? Do they sell you the gold? How does it work?
Absolutely not. Whether you've got physical metals that you want to ship to us safely, or whether you want to simply send a bank wire or a check, we can convert your money into gold and get you started earning interest right away.
All right, everybody, check it out. monetary-metals.com/woods. I have an account there. I know the people who work there. We all know Jeff Deist. So check it out for yourself, monetary-metals.com/woods. So then the question of, is there a best way to become strong? Well, you've more or less answered that. There are ways that are better than others.
Yeah, I did. I kind of went into that through the answer to the previous question.
Yeah.
And once you're finished with that novice phase, it does become more complicated. The process I mentioned, you know, the stress that you apply, recover, and adapt. When you're a novice, being a novice, a lot of people have a misunderstanding. It doesn't really have to do with how strong you are. If you're somebody who has the potential to be a Division I lineman, you might be lifting 500 pounds and still be a novice because you're a behemoth of a human being. So a novice has to do with how quickly you can go through that cycle, that process. Apply the stress, recover from that stress, be adapted to a new stress to be able to do a little more. And the definition of a novice is that you can do that every 2 to 3 days, or let's call it multiple times per week. You can, let's say, do 500 on Monday, rest on Tuesday, and do it again Wednesday or Thursday. You know, maybe in the later stages, you do a lighter day. So you do it Monday, maybe you take a lighter day Wednesday and do it again Friday. So you can do it multiple times per week. So for a 65-year-old woman who's doing it for the first time, she might be lifting 50 pounds as a novice. And for a 20-year-old college football player, he might be lifting 600 pounds and be a novice. It has to do with how quickly your body can go through that cycle. Once you're finished with a novice phase, wherever you finish it up at, that will be different weights for different people, right? Just like some people are virtuosos at learning the violin and other people takes, you know, they kind of aren't that good at it. Some people will finish their novice phase with a 200-pound squat and some people with a 500-pound squat. Wherever you finish that novice phase, depending on all of those factors, age, sex, genetic affinity for it, it does become a little trickier. And the idea of best way to do it kind of gives way to guidelines rather than rules. The really good thing about the novice phase is it's basically hard rules that work for everybody every time. I don't know how many hundreds of people I've taken through this process, at least 500. It might be closer to 1,000 at this point. And I can think of one time where it didn't work. It really works. It's like a universal rule. Once you're out of the novice phase, it's a little harder to know the exact timing of that cycle. That stress recovery adaptation cycle is still the underlying process, but it gets mixed up with more fatigue because you're stronger. Once you get stronger, you're able to apply more fatigue to your body. Now, you also get better at recovering because everything, you know, all those physiological processes improve as you train them, but you still are carrying, you tend to be carrying more fatigue when, let's say, your workload on Monday, you know, is several sets of 300 pounds. That's a lot more fatigue than it was 6 months ago when it was several sets of 100 pounds. So it takes a little longer to recover. So timing that kind of the up end of that cycle, the stress recovery adaptation, hitting another workout right at the top of that cycle becomes a little trickier. It's still pretty good. We have pretty good rules for it for another 6 months or so after the novice phase, but it does get a little trickier right away. And especially after you've been doing it for, let's say, more than a year, it does become trickier. So that's where there is literature about this too. Ripito wrote a book called Practical Programming for Strength Training, which is pretty good. And a lot of people get stuff from that. The co-author of that book, I know I'm kind of name dropping some other people, instead of promoting myself, but that's okay. His name is Andy Baker. He has some good podcasts and material on that. And I have some on my Substack as well about kind of managing things in that post-novice phase. It does become a little trickier, and it goes from rules to guidelines, and it takes a little bit of wisdom and experience to know how to apply those guidelines in a way that the novice phase really, it's so simple. It's not easy, but it's so simple that pretty much anybody can do it. Follow the rules, you will get better.
All right, well, here's the big question. The question everybody has to answer on that show.
Okay.
Which is, tell me about the BS in this area, because there's a conventional wisdom in everything, and it's not always wrong. But in this day and age, it seems like the more we look into conventional wisdoms in different areas, the more they do turn out to be wrong. So what can you say about, let's say, the science, if we may use that infelicitous phrase here, as it applies to strength?
Well, I could say a lot. So I know it's supposed to be about a half an hour show. Do we have 2 hours?
We have time. It's okay.
Okay. So there, one of the things is one of them that we already discussed. A lot of the doctors who have no knowledge or experience in this field will just tell people, you never have to lift heavy. You can just do cardio. You know, it'll be like, oh, just do lower weight with more reps. And that's not really even based in any, not even based in fake science. It's just really based in their opinion that they don't know anything about. Because we have 70-year-old women who we coach who can lift 150, 200 pounds on a regular basis. Not the first day, of course. They start at a much lower weight, but nothing's happening to them. They're not hurting their back. They're actually reducing or eliminating their back pain. So this idea that lifting heavy is inherently dangerous or bad, that's kind of held by a lot of lay people and even doctors giving advice to people. That's BS, but that actually isn't really based on any literature. That's just kind of conventional wisdom that people have that may be based on old stuff that hasn't been current in a while. And in terms of the science, a little more specific, the science. So I like to call them the evidence-based boys. It's kind of like evidence-based medicine in a sense. There's a group of people, some of them are in academia, some of them have degrees, sometimes terminal degrees, but now themselves work outside of academia. And some people don't even have degrees. They've just kind of found themselves as influencers in this field who hold a very, very narrow, peculiar view of this, that anything you claim in this field, like all of the stuff that I just claimed, is invalid unless I can source it to a peer-reviewed journal citation. And as opposed to saying, okay, we have a lot of data being generated just from people going to the gym for decades and decades, from coaches coaching people for decades and decades. That might not be randomized and published in a journal, but it's data. It's useful information that we can learn things from. Instead of saying that, they basically say, unless you can source anything you claim to a citation in a peer-reviewed journal, it's invalid. And in some ways, that's a little bit different from COVID because it's not enforced with a might of the state, doesn't have your local public health official's order behind it. It probably has a little bit less funding tomfoolery because, you know, we don't have big influences of things like the pharmaceutical industry. But the funding for these research things still does come from mostly from government. And, you know, you have a PhD, you know how the small fiefdoms and academic egos can be, whether it's reputation, tenure, or even just status as an online influencer based on knowing the literature, you know, or having a degree in that field, a PhD in that field is what gives you your reputation as somebody that people should listen to. You're not going to say that that literature is full of BS, because if you question the system that it's based on, then suddenly your PhD becomes a lot less valuable. So you have those kind of problems. So in that way, it's very similar to COVID in that you have a group of mostly credentialed people who kind of claim themselves as the sole source of truth. And the key thing that I always come back to is there's no amount of real world results to the contrary that can be used against them because, you know, quote unquote, that's just an anecdote. So for example, you know, what you pointed out with your like COVID charts quiz, the real world data was just over and over again coming out and showing how all of these various measures didn't work. But that didn't matter to these people because all the experts were saying it did work and the CDC was coming out every other week with a new, you know, non-randomized, non-controlled trial that says masks are amazing. So the idea was that the only thing that can change the mind of the official experts is somebody within their circle who will never question the dogma within their circle. So no amount of real-world results, no amount of real-world evidence can question the literature. And, you know, the thing they say all the time is the plural of anecdote is not data. And I actually wrote a piece on this in my Substack called The Plural of Anecdote is Data. I didn't know this. I found out when I was researching this article that the original quote, it was said by a Berkeley poli-sci professor, I forget the exact year, late 60s or early 70s. His quote that he used was the plural of anecdote is data, because someone in his class had made an assertion and based on something he personally observed. And someone else in the class said, oh, well, you can't use that. And the professor responded, his last name was Wolfinger, not related to me, but Professor Wolfinger responded, well, the plural of anecdote is data. And that was his quote. And he was a poli-sci professor. So there are sometimes good people in academia. I think what I speculated in my article is that the reason why the quote was corrupted so quickly within his own lifetime is if you look at the Google engram for peer review, it shoots up right around the mid-60s to early 70s. Before then, peer review, it wasn't non-existent. It started coming on the scene a few decades earlier. One of the things I had an exchange with Dr. Bhattacharya a couple of weeks ago where we were talking about this, and he mentioned how when he tells people that Einstein's seminal papers were not peer-reviewed, people don't believe him. Peer review was not a thing back then. The amount of science that we have and technological progress that we have that had never been through the peer review process is probably has had a greater impact in humanity than that which has. It really started coming to prominence in the mid-60s to early 70s. So what I think is that when peer review kind of became the standard truth-seeking mechanism, that quote was corrupted to fit the new paradigm, even though it was the opposite of the way it was originally said. So the critiques against the literature can only come from inside the literature. Anything you see, no matter how far to the contrary, does not count. And the issues with the exercise literature are very many. The main issues that I would point to, small sample sizes. I'll give a couple examples in a minute, but very small sample sizes. Short study durations, usually 8 to 12 weeks, so they don't tell you anything about long-term progress, long-term trends. We have an inability to isolate many variables. I was a biology major in college, and all of our experiments, we isolated all the variables. So at the end, you knew what the result was. And if somebody in the class didn't get it, you knew they messed up the experiment. Whereas here, we have so many variables unisolated. Like, for example, if we're trying to do a study on which strength training protocol is better. Well, are they all eating the same? What if some of them are eating too few calories? Or what if them are eating too many unhealthy things? Are they sleeping the same? Are they sleeping 8 hours a night? Some of them are sleeping 2 hours a night. What is their motivation? Some people are motivated to train. Other people kind of show up and, you know, lollygag. Outside stress, are people going through difficult things with their relationship with their... A lot of times they take the samples from college, undergrad or graduate students. Are they going through stress with their exams? What is their exact training history? They'll say, well, these are experienced lifters or not experienced lifters. It's not very specific. Genetic potential is a huge difference, right? We know some people are born athletes, other people are not. These variables are never isolated. And of course, there's no ability to blind because you can't even do, forget about double blinding, you can't even do single blinding because whatever you're doing, you always know what it's going to be. So all the statistical analyses in the world and regressions can't correct for all of these variables that we don't isolate without massive sample sizes. Have you spoken? I know you've had a lot of really great COVID experts that I've benefited from listening to so many of those shows. Have you spoken to Harvey Risch from Yale?
No, I tried to get him on, but he at that time wasn't doing podcasts.
Okay. So he did a lecture, I want to say late last year, that I saw. It was about a 20 or 25 minute lecture about some of the problems with evidence-based medicine. And one of the things he was talking about was how evidence-based medicine, they don't use big enough samples to catch all of the potential safety issues. Because if you have, let's say, a drug that will have a 1 in 30,000 adverse event effect, and you have 50,000 people in your study with 25,000 in the placebo arm and 25,000 in the study arm, but it has a 1 in 30,000 thing, you're probably not going to catch it. Even if you have over 30,000 people in the thing, like it's not like it's going to happen 1 in every 30,000. That's just the average amount. So he talks about how those studies, even with tens of thousands of people, are not sufficiently powered. I want you to take a guess, Tom. How many people do you think are in the average strength training exercise science study?
Oh, I don't dare guess. What is the answer?
That's it. Just guess. Do humor me.
Well, the problem is, like, if I screw it up, then I ruin your whole
Okay. Fair enough. 10 to 30
okay,
is the normal range.
What number would you say we would need for this to be meaningful at all?
Well, let's think about I won't say they're not meaningful at all, but let's think about all of the variables I talked about that we don't have isolated. Genetic potential of individuals, how much they are willing to push. A lot of these studies go to voluntary fatigue. Voluntary fatigue for me might be 2 reps more than for that guy because I'm willing to push hard. Nutrition, sleep, external stressors, all of those various things that I mentioned, and probably a couple more. I think you would need at least in the hundreds of thousands, maybe the millions. I don't know. I'm not a statistician. You know, someone's going to correct me and think, but you would need way more than we have, 10 to 30 on average. Some of the studies that I'll reference below are 13, and they're considered studies that people have, I have seen people actually use to try to, evidence-based people with terminal degrees use to try to make a point. 13 subjects. How much validity are you going to get from 13 subjects? Now, you could say we observed that we found this, so it's worth further study, but they use that as like, this is the way, and if you don't have a citation, you can't argue with it. So a lot of these studies have 10 to, you know, not a lot, almost all of them have 10 to 30 people. So you can't really do this statistical regressions to get good data out of that. One of the other, I'm sorry, do you look like you have a question?
Well,
I'm about to ramble on.
What would be, I could understand in some areas of study, what the motivation might be to confuse people by coming up with bogus results and touting them as gospel. In this case, what do these people stand to gain?
I don't think they're using small subjects like that because they want to bamboozle people. I think it's very hard to get subjects for these studies. They're not super well funded. But I think the reason it's not super well funded is because most people intuitively realize that the discipline isn't that great and we can learn more via other methods than this, than kind of, not for the same reasons, but kind of like empirical things aren't, empirical studies aren't necessarily always the best way to learn things about economics if you come from the Austrian side. These kind of empirical inquiries aren't always at least done via the academic peer-reviewed method. Empiricism is important for this because it's, you can't logically deduce everything from an axiom, but you can often get better data from things that aren't a peer-reviewed subject of 13. If I coach 500 people, it may not be randomized, but that gives me better data than a peer-reviewed study of 13 people. So I don't think they're trying to bamboozle you with a small sample size. I think it's a matter of, it's hard to get subjects for this. It's hard to get people to commit to an 8 or 12 week thing that they show up at the same time every day.
Right. I understand the challenges. I guess my thought would be, how would you and I respond to those challenges? We'd say, well, I guess this is not going to be a way we're going to be able to get information.
So what you would have to do, if you were honest, you would have to shrink the size of your own prestige. And then that is why I don't think they want to do it. You have to admit that what you do is not really the most influential, maybe even the best way, at least at current time, to get information about this topic. So how many people are going to go into the PhD field? How many people, once they have a PhD, are going to say, yeah, my whole line of study really isn't that important. You might get better results from just copying what the biggest guy at the gym does. I think that's kind of what I mentioned before, kind of the academic egos, the small little fiefdoms of influencers. A lot of people that I've observed in the space just want to be, you know, science-based, evidence-based. It sounds very intellectual. Oh, like the cavemen chuds are in there just grunting and doing heavy weight, but we are very science-based. We are smarter, or we're that kind of attitude.
Okay.
That seems to drive a lot of it. So for the people in academia, it's their position, it's their tenure or their desire to get tenure. But for people who are not in academia, it seems to be, you know, it's just, science has a good reputation. Science gave us airplanes, automobiles, antibiotics. Attaching things to science-based or evidence-based has a lot of appeal to people. Sometimes it sells for that reason. So even though in this case, I don't think the science is created equal, it does have an attraction and you can sometimes build an audience on that. And then if you say, well, actually this isn't as rigorous as physical chemistry, you're going to lose some of that audience. You're going to lose some of that prestige.
Hey everybody, quick word from Woods here. It's my goal to have the best supporters program out there, better than anything on Patreon or anywhere else. Support the Tom Woods Show. And not only do you get entry into my no censorship Tom Woods Show elite group, but you also get the 16-page Tom Woods Elite Letter mailed to your home every month. Who else is doing that? This is all new material, completely different from the emails I send, and it is red hot. My supporters also get invites to my murder mystery dinner parties that I've been holding around the country. I'll be adding more cities soon to woodsmystery.com. I hold these in penthouse suites at luxury hotels with a beautiful catered dinner. It's a ton of fun. I also invite my supporters to my annual Christmas party. And the higher up you go as a supporter, the more things you get. Some supporters even get a small gift in the mail from me every month in addition to the newsletter. So go check it out, supportinglisteners.com. You will not believe all the goodies at supportinglisteners.com. And my profound thanks to all of you. All right, so now just imagine you're an ordinary layman who says, you know, I really should get off my rear end and get in the gym and do something and make myself stronger because it's good for my health. It's good for my longevity, we presume. But I have all this conflicting advice from various sources. So I don't know what exactly my regimen should look like. Well, obviously now here's your opportunity if you want to promote, you know, ways to read and contact you. But okay. Also, I mean, what would be the basic answer? I mean, I feel like I'm asking the same kind of question that I asked Peter Schiff when he comes on, and somebody wants to know, what if I have $10,000 to invest? Because Peter's usually managing millions at a time. Where would you send me? Where do you send the complete beginner who wants to start from a good foundation and not like start doing the wrong thing and then have to change it?
Right. So that is a good, really good place to get a coach. It is an investment. You know, you're paying for somebody's experience, expertise, and time. So, you know, you can work with me as a coach. I work with a company now that's called Barbell Logic. I'm an independent contractor, but I work with them and it is pricey. I forget the exact amount. It's about $200 or so dollars a month. Not everyone's going to do that. So I will give some other tips besides that, but that is a really, really good way to start. One thing I will be happy to do also for your listeners, just because I'm a big fan of the show and I've gained a lot from it. I don't usually check my messages from people I don't know, you know, that goes in a different folder. But for the next few weeks after this, if somebody is on Instagram or on Twitter and sends me a DM, I'll make sure to check at least a few times a week. I obviously can't do full-scale coaching for you, but as just a thank you, I'll answer a question or two that you have. You know, I can't spend 3 hours looking at all of your lists for 2 weeks straight. But if you have a question, I'll make sure to check those parts of my direct messages on Twitter and Instagram and answer those for you. Hiring a coach, you can hire me. You can also DM me to learn how to hire me via Barbell Logic. I'll walk you through that process. So you can contact me directly to do that. But if you're not somebody, either you don't think it's worth it at this point or that's too much of an investment, you can sometimes go to an in-person coach in your area and just get one lesson on how to do the lifts. And that will send you a long way. So I would look for a starting strength coach in your area, even though I'm not affiliated with them anymore. They still produce very good coaches. Every single organization has one or two that slip through the cracks, but Starting Strength has the least. It's the most rigorous. The organization I work with is mostly online coaching, but there are some Barbell Logic coaches who are very good too that do in-person coaching. So look for a Starting Strength coach or a Barbell Logic coach near you. And now if you're not even going to do that, if you say, I just want to do it on my own, I would still advise that person to A, read my Substack, but B, probably before that, my Substack is more for people who are a little bit familiar with it. Go in and read Starting Strength. Just get the book. It's the best-selling book on lifting in the world. Even if there might be one or two little things in there that I have a slightly different take on, it's still by far the most comprehensive, best text. And then once you've gone through it, there are videos online, tutorial videos. I've got a few on. I don't really have an active YouTube channel. I put up a video a couple times a year. I've got some tutorials on the deadlift and the press and some other lifts. The Starting Strength channel has some great tutorials and the Barbell Logic YouTube channel, all three of those places. Mine is Wolf Strength and Conditioning. It's not very active, but I've got a few good videos. Barbell Logic YouTube channel, Starting Strength YouTube channel. Those are all places that have tutorials where if you say, okay, I read this text, but I can't visualize what this looks like, or I tried it and I was obviously doing it all wrong. What is this supposed to look like? Sometimes the verbal learning only takes you so far. You need some visual. So if you need visual, you can go to YouTube and check those tutorials out and that will help. And if you try it and you're still really unsuccessful, I do recommend, it really is worth the investment, even if it's just a one-time session to go through the main lifts. It usually takes about an hour and a half maybe to go through like four main lifts, maybe 2 hours if you're a little slower. And that really is worth the investment.
All right. Well, I got to ask you one more thing. So obviously, sure, strength training can make you look better, but what are other reasons somebody might do it? Health reasons. What exactly is it doing for you other than making you look like somebody who goes to the gym? Like, what is it doing for you that we should be happy about?
So Actually, the first article I ever wrote for broad publication is on this topic.
Oh.
It's called Strength and Barbells, The Foundations of Fitness. Ripetoe published it on his website in 2012. It's still up there. I put a slightly updated version on my Substack. I'll try to, it's probably a 10 to 15 minute read. So I'll try to give the short version. I tried to lay out before strength, the production of force against an external resistance is really the basis of how we interact with our entire physical environment, right? Whether you're walking, whether you're riding a bike, whether you're running, doing anything you do, picking something up off the floor, that is producing force with your limbs, with your through your torso to move things. So anytime you increase your capacity to do that, yeah, we live in the first world. You're not baling 50-pound bales of hay all day. So it's not like you need to have a 600-pound deadlift to live in the first world. But getting stronger beyond where the normal person is, most people can, if you take, again, that healthy average man, 20 to 40 years old, he's going to get his deadlift up over 300 pounds within a few months, sometimes less. Going from zero to 300, going from zero to 400 will make a profound difference in all of those things in your life. You don't have to get to 600, you don't have to get to 700. Those are levels of specialization for a competitive lifter or somebody who makes it, you know, their whole lifestyle. You don't have to do that. Get your deadlift up to 300 or 350. It'll make a profound difference in your ability to produce force. And this has ramifications for, you know, whether you're working, think about something like, if you've got to pick up an awkward object that's heavy off the ground, let's say an awkward, you know, a sack of 50 pounds, or you've got to, you know, move the lawnmower and adjust the lawnmower. Well, that thing doesn't weigh 315 pounds, but it's awkwardly shaped and you're in an awkward position. So if a deadlift, which allows you to lift ergonomically in a sound manner or a squat, if you can do that with 200 or 300 pounds, maybe more, then you, when you've got to lift the 50 pound thing, instead of being heavy, it's so submaximal that you don't wrench your back. It's so submaximal that it doesn't cause you any fits, doesn't cause you any problems. And then when you get older, of course, you know, what's the way that a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of older people meet their demise is they lose the ability to produce enough force to locomote properly. They fall down and they break their pelvis. And the 6-month survival rate for a pelvic break is not very good. If the stronger you are, the more you have in the tank to locomote properly, to catch yourself properly on the ice, on a staircase, things like that, so that those kind of things don't happen as you get older. And your ability to put those dollars in the, those kind of strength dollars in the bank when you're younger, the younger you are, the more you can time you have to put it in the bank. And even something as simple as getting up off a chair or off the pot in the bathroom, we take it for granted. You know, I know you call yourself old woods, but we're still young enough to take it for granted. But what about when you're 75 or 85? You know, you might live till you're 90, but what if the last 12 years you need help to get up off the bathroom?
Yeah.
Versus production of force and external resistance, even if it doesn't make you live any longer, you're going to be able to do that until, you know, until the end.
Yeah, because, but see, in a way, by giving me some additional quality of life, I feel like in a way I am living longer because I'm living more livable years. Like if I'm confined to my living room and I can't move around, I'm halfway in the grave already, I feel like.
Yeah, and I don't want to stretch too much to relate everything to the COVID stuff, but I think that is a similar theme in that, you know, existing, biological existing is not the same as living. Of course, we also want to just live a longer life, but if the last 10 years are just existing and you can't even get up off a chair or out of the bathroom by yourself, that's not really living in the way that we would like to do it. So it does really add a lot of kind of quality years that you can put those in the bank now.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so I'm going to put your links in the description of the video and also at tomwoods.com/2472 because you are the guy to consult on stuff like this and people, you should read what Wolf here writes and listen to what he says.
Can I drop him real quick verbally?
Yeah, why not?
Okay, great. So on Twitter, I'm at Wolf Strength, spelled like the animal, W-O-L-F. At Twitter is at Wolf Strength. Instagram, somebody had that, so I had to put an underscore between Wolf and Strength. So Instagram is at Wolf_Strength. And on Substack, I had to come up with a clever name for it. So it's my Twitter name, not my handle, is the same as my Substack. That's Deep Squats, Shallow Thoughts.
Okay. Yeah, we've been corresponding, and so I noticed that. Okay, so I'll make sure all that is up on the page and in the description. So I think we'll wrap it up here. And thanks for the information. And for, again, I like it's not every conventional wisdom is wrong, but enough of them are wrong that let's just say the Tom Woods Show is not going to be put out of business anytime soon. And I appreciate you coming on and explaining things for the audience as to the way they should think about all this stuff. So thanks so much.
It was a pleasure to be on. Thank you, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.